I'm very excited to have Linda McCarriston here. Like Vincent Farini, poet Linda McCarriston is a native of Lynn. She has two sons and four granddaughters. It took her much longer to settle in Gloucester than it did Vincent. She treasures a copy of No Smoke that he gave her in 2002. Educated in Lynn's Catholic schools, she won some high school writing prizes. On the day she was to receive a Boston Globe Journalism Award, she was unable to get the afternoon off from her job and couldn't attend the ceremony. She did get to the University of Alaska, where she taught poetry for 21 years, and she did get to the National Book Awards in 1992 for her second book of poems. Talking Soft Dutch and Little River are likewise still in print. She has published poems widely in The Atlantic, Poetry, and many other journals, and has received fellowships from the NEA, Vermont Council of the Arts, and the Bunting Institute of Radcliffe College. She has also published prose, especially on issues related to the working class, and is proud to say that her work, both teaching and writing, has often gotten her into trouble. Linda McCarriston.
Thank you so much. I have avoided giving readings since I escaped Alaska and the academic life. I really just kind of came down here and came back home and hid out over at the barn with the people who, you know, the horse people and lots of other people, but I didn't go around saying, "Do you want to know who I am and what I've been doing the last..." No, I didn't do that. And so when I got getting ready for tonight, it was kind of a big deal. I was reading through everything with an idea of what I might like to do. And I didn't get obsessive or anything, but anyway, I realized that what I was going to do was read... this book is really... This is the one that went to the National Book Awards. And this book is about... growing up in Lynn in a violent, alcoholic, Irish Catholic home. And it's really a book about ideas in the sense that it's concentric circles of power that surrounded the family that kept all of that in place. And the church is a big part of that, the church and the state, the law, the medical field, all of it. But to succeed, the poems that... needed to be written, needed to be violent poems. And they needed to be in the first person. So they couldn't be said to be myth or fiction or anything else. And so as I went through and reread them, I thought, I've made friends among these people, and this is a very mean thing to do to them, to subject them to some of these poems. So I wanted to do... I want to spread things around a little more, and I'll read fewer of those. And if I can find what I was doing, I hate being late, and I promised people that who came to my birthday party where I didn't show up that it would not happen here. Okay. First poem I want to read is called Girl from Lynn Bathes Horse, which back in the day when I was a kid, I mean, the idea that you would have a horse in Lynn would be like, I don't know, maybe having a camel in Lynn. It's called Girl from Lynn Bathes Horse. And of course, I never thought I'd ever read it anywhere where people didn't come from either Lynn or Marblehead or Gloucester or Salem or Beverly. And so when I found myself far away, I had to explain the cultural connotations of Lynn and why the title was ironic, and so that they had to understand that. Girl from Lynn Bathes Horse. 1,100 pounds, more or less, the mare high steps a trot on a short circle, 2 feet of line from the hand of the tenement kid who never outgrew the wish to be able to do this, to the head of the horse who never watched TV, never saw the Lone Ranger or Hoppy, never read about Smokey or Flicka, Black Beauty or King of the Wind, and so cannot possibly know that the only thing the two of them need to perform this difficult, dangerous act together is love. The kind between cowgirl and pony, infused as the garden's knowing. To hell with experience, instruction, example, coin of the grown-up world. You don't really need what you don't really own. In her offhand, the stiff hose kinks coiling underfoot as the mare circles, hating the green snake, the water that spurts, urging her faster, crosser at every turn, in the tight well of mud, in the slick-footing flood of the yard. It's a lot like washing a car, she quips as a shod hoof flies out when the wet slaps horse privates. It's always like something else, this life, for which squirting a half ton of horse in hand on the strength of a 9-year-old's metaphysics is a figure for all the rest. For the morning by morning invention of a self in the laboratory of unmarked chemicals. Childhood is the barrel they give you to go over the falls in. Whatever you get to take with you in it can't be bigger or sharper than an idea. It must be that fall, clenched in a kid's fist, as earth expresses a diamond, that transforms it from simply some dumb thing to some dumb thing that is magic. The fifth essence, perhaps, what the alchemists knew lay latent in everything, even the least, even the most ridiculous. Mm-hmm. The next poem that I wanted to read is called Bucked. And I believe it's in here. On the way to getting a horse, of course. I mean, I didn't have the money for lessons ever, never had taken lessons. So, but I had, you know, like, I don't know, I had the money to buy a horse. So I bought it and got on it. This little horse was actually not mine. This was a loaner and a naughty boy. He appears in another poem. This is called Bucked. Balanced for that instant in midair, I watched his rump in white slow motion rise, heart cleft, perfect, to deliver the awesome blow. How beautiful the muscles of the world in their uses. Great limbs of trees, waves scaling sea walls, the moon's dreadful flecks on everything, heart valves and minute vessels, the spiraled cues for weakness that I pass on to my children, of which might one ask to be spared? And another little poem, since time is not terribly long. Little poem that when I wrote it, I wasn't really fully aware of what I was writing. And over the years, it became more apparent to me. So I should have a tall gravestone, and it should have this on it for a short person. Called trees. Trees and stands are families. Farmed that way by accident or design, defined by meadow, they wear the shape of some man's hand. The pasture pine, a volunteer, wrenches itself upward, unprotected. It is a weather vane. It is the one that ruptures stone walls. Here's another horse poem. This is the same horse on a day when he was being better. And you'll get his name in this poem. We are only walking. This is not the romance of horseback riding. Your mane, which is short and scraggly, sticks out like a hedge of cowlicks or merely flops off to the side. Nothing is flying, transporting, transcendent. Then we aren't a metaphor for anything, Shawnee James, little borrowed horse I learn on. Your body is bent and dented as the first car I owned, the 52 Plymouth, brush painted, one walleye headlight held in with masking tape, and I am a comparable model. But cast off the road, our shadow is traveling across the cut stubble of October. My hands have forgotten themselves, as the shadow has forgotten them, does not require them. With your four legs, our two heads find a balance. A single thing in gray, its many muscles, flush and flexing in everyday grace, we move over the grass, as whole as the shape anything makes, passing. We are something going somewhere, handsome and practical and proud. We shake out our tail. This is called Quincy's Harvest Moon. And I owned Quincy for a short while. She was very, very old. And I bought her. And everyone in Vermont had learned to ride on Quincy. And finally, there was nobody to learn except myself. And I was not a kid. But I, the girl who, for the price of the horse, she bought a show shirt to wear when she was riding and, dressage and whatnot. And Quincy was wonderful. Actually, her name was Quintessence, which is kind of astonishing when you think about it. And this was just, all day the wind has ruffled the fading green the way a man might rough and tumble up his dog, his old dog, fondly, mock savage. September is like that. Goodbye, tired fields, I rode through. Grumpy soft woods growing stiffer every morning. Dowagers, dear cronies. And late tonight, feigning domestic chores outside, I join the gravid harvest moon barely clearing the ridge to visit the old horse. In the near pasture, I say her name, not loudly, not a call. Under the blood and gutsy moon that shapes with forge light the mountain, the orchard, the fine back and rump and neck of the mare. Of course she walks toward me, as on all the nights of all the years, bearing her star ahead of her on her own field of dark, the bay gracious gift of her body. Square off the horizon, that star comes, will come for years, a new beast in the sky of the heart's imagination. We smell each other. She takes the apple. I hold her head again, watching even this heartiest, goldenest of moons up and up transpire, ever paler, more distant to spirit. I almost started to cry. You know, what happens in these books in the larger sense is the speaker is a child that grows up in a very violent house, very violated, and who reaches for help to the Catholic Church and really the only place, in confession. Is told that God wants us to mind our parents. I think it was Father Welch, and it was Holy Family Church, and it was, I think he sort of reached around behind things and tried to get my father to, I don't know, sleep on the beach after work instead of coming back to the house. But the child that grows up in these poems is saved by horses, because she loves them and they love her back. And it is really a children's story come to life in that she has no business being anywhere near a horse, and she never gets seriously hurt. And in fact, she, at the age of 40, she gets the horse that she always wanted. And that horse died in Rockport 4 years ago, at the age of 30, after having been taken up to Alaska with me when I took the job, and then gone down to Wyoming on my sabbatical year, and then back up to Alaska, and then back to Maine and Vermont, and down to Massachusetts again. Mm-hmm. And that's called Riding Mariah, and I think I'll find it in a second. But I have to read this because today's the first day of spring. I got a chance to read at the State House not long after the book came out, and with the Vermont Poet Laureate, who was an elderly, elegant, dignified, older man, older than I was at that point, and with his shirt and tie and suit jacket. And I got to read my poem, Spring, in front of him and everyone else. Downroot, everyone knows the word dressing, side dressing or dressing a garden is fertilizing, generally putting fertilizer on top, like alongside or whatever they call it, side dressing. Downroot too, the farmers are hauling hen dressing in flat open wagons. The stink is terrific. The fields on either side fan out in long arcs of mud and shiny stubble. Even the crows laboring from tree to tree seem fresh, and everything is ready to start over. So a tractor heaves off over the shallow bank, and the farmer hums or whistles, thinking of his cows, his taxes, or his woman, while today paints a first wash of red over his face and forearms. Saddled to his big John Deere, he throws the spreader switch, flinging the stuff in every direction, then rides on through the stench and roar like a free man, like a man on top of something other than a half ton of chicken shit, like how you imagine a rich man, maybe, with his money. So I need to go next to called Birthday Girl, 1953 or something, and I think it's in here. It's very interesting, you know, when I was writing, these poems were written while I was a student, and any indication that I was not middle class, I mean, more, you know, upper middle class, was really... I've written an essay about it that's actually gone all over the place. It's been taught in a lot of classrooms about the controls in writing contemporary poetry that are about class. And I can make it available to anyone who wants it. It's been reprinted here and there. And this was one of those poems, you know. I mean, My teachers wanted the best for me. So they didn't want me writing these poems about the things that had happened and writing in the language, you know, which was considered angry. And, but it was, you know, it was, for me, live or die. And I had to, those poems were going to, they were going to eat somebody alive. So, Birthday Girl, for my mother. The day the package came from Sears, you were ironing and smoking in the one slab of light that elbowed in between R3 Decker and the next one. World Series time, and the radio bobbing on the square end of the board told over what you already knew. The socks are the same old bunch of bums, you said, slamming the iron into some navy gabardine. The smells of work clothes, tide and oil, rose up together in steam around you, like the roar of the crowd at Fenway and the shouts downstairs of Imelda getting belted around her kitchen at noon. Some people can make anything out of anything else. If you still can, remember that day like this. You douse your cigarette and squat down close. I open the box addressed only to me and find inside the pair of sandals you call harlequin with straps as many colored as a life. I am happy. You buckle them on me. Every room is dark but where we are. Every other room is empty. that poem leads, and again, not consciously, but I realized later, it leads inevitably into the poems of the book that is terrible in a certain way. And it was one of five finalists nationally for the National Book Award. I couldn't believe it, you know. I was at the National Book Awards. Anyhow, with my two sons, they gave me $500, you know, as one of the four or one of the five. And with that 500, I took the train from Vermont, went down to New York, met my sons, got a room, rented tuxes, went to the dinner, ate free, and then went out for cheesecake. And that was so that's what we did that night. And this is a poem about my brother, and that's the name of the poem is Billy. And it sort of links to that dark room. As though a bare bulb hung over your head, as it does in movie scenes of interrogation, you are the single vivid thing in the shades of gray memory, the white center out from which the whole dank tenement cellar, the dirt floor, the boulders that formed the old foundation, the three fat coal-burning furnaces, one for each of the three stories, the coal bins, punky across from each, the mud-thick little windows above that were coal chutes when the truck came, the new table saw overhead work light, and even our father, who stood beating you with his fists where he'd stuck you into a barrel, as a mountaineer might plant a banner into a peak to keep your skinny 13-year-old self erect till he was finished. The whole rest emanates and fades. It was winter. You had driven your homemade go-kart into a door that he was saving for something. I can see the little V's you made in the paint. I see his upper body plunging up and down like one of those wind-driven lawn ornaments, the one that is pumping. The barrel reaches your bottom. You must be holding onto it. It must be braced against his table saw. There are no words. The barrel bangs and scrapes. Your body sounds different than a mattress. The noises he makes are the noises of a man trying to lift a Buick off the body of a loved child, whose face he can see upturned just above the wheel that rests on her chest, her eyes right on his eyes, as yours were on mine. And there, you know, the one after that is called A Castle in Lynn, and it's about my father's ideas as Catholic male about sexual access, I think almost sexual duty. I mean, you know, you really have to be kind of first-generation Irish Catholic, maybe from County Down, maybe from wherever, I mean, to have these ideas so seamless. But they really did fit in, you know, a man's home is his castle, and it was true in those days. I mean, and I'm not going to read it because I don't have time. You'll just have to buy the book. But I thought I would like to read My Mother's Chair, which goes together with the others. One foot tucked under, like a nesting bird, night after night she sat in the platform rocker, her eyes on something I could not see, her black Indian Scorpio eyes on no object in the air of the material room. She rocked like a man rowing his loved children out of harm's way, out of the path of the ocean tanker that bore down on them, out of the fog where he'd drifted by mistake in the little loving rowboat of his life. With the muscles of her arms, she rowed, she rocked in that chair, going nowhere, getting out of nothing's way with the muscles of her thighs, with her jaw, with her shoulders. From the kitchen, I could watch her be a piston, staying put in the stanchion of her life with the muscles of her back, with her hands clamped on the arms of the rocker, as though by strength she could turn it to a wheel and steer, or the reins to a wagon that she might take up and slap on the backs of the horses. As a child beats a stick on the cage of an animal, so a certain world was playing on her soul. I stood out of sight, who was too small to leave behind, who was too big to carry. With the muscles of her neck, with the muscles of her chest, she plunged against the leg trap that must have been under her. The black telephone, exquisite as a photo postcard on its own small table, could listen to her rocket, could hear the chair threaten to soar. She never lifted the receiver. She never asked the black wire to take her where it could. Having already traveled, a pilgrim, on foot, to that priest, to that judge, to that doctor. And I think I have time. I don't know.
Go ahead.
There are two poems that are at the end. Well, I know. She didn't make this cut. I mean, it's funny the way something picks you, and it's going to be the avenue through which something creative gets made. I mean, I have a poem about Mariah that I love, but it's completely not about any of this stuff. It's about her joie. It's just about her joie, and it's not in this book even, but. It was Quincy who was really the, yes, I'll have to come back. I'll be here every Wednesday from 9 to 12. I'm going to just read this one more poem. There's a whole bunch of good Irish poems in here, too, that I wanted to read you about being in a bar in Ireland, you know, coming from the culture. And I have to read it because there's a little portion of it where I managed to get the inflection, the Irish inflection comes into the metrical aspects, comes in through the metrical aspect of the line. Local. In an Irish pub, Vatican of stout and fags, I travel back a family generation to the land of an honest man's failing. With such, no other island is so richly endowed. I myself was many years inclined to honesty, but now deceive myself, perhaps, and others, having come a decade more ago to the crossroad where the pure refusal of a drunk's grave meets the compromise of walking the crooked lane conscious. I cannot bear to watch the man who so delights them in a parody of dance, but watch them watch him with smiles that shine communal and benign, whose brother, just months past, himself was swept like an ill-advised explorer in the ocean caves below this Fisher Street bar, away in the gay and honest waves of drink, turned savage in the inner world, turned toothed and clawed in the changeless village tide that always turns. Mm-hmm. And this is called Le Corsier de Jeanne d'Arc. She had Joan of Arc, and this poem owes its existence to my seeing that statue of Joan of Arc that's in front of the Veterans Memorial there. When I was a child, you know, I went nowhere. Where did we go? From Lynn? Did I never even got into Boston? I might as well have lived in a box until, you know. But we drove to Gloucester. We must have driven to Gloucester because I saw this, and it was in my life. I thought, look at that, you know. I mean, and Joan was my middle name. And Joan had two kinds of horses. She had saddle horses. That could be mine for all I know. She had saddle horses, light riding horses, and then she had the chargers, the Percherons, that were big enough and heavy enough to carry the weight of the armor. So those, that was pretty typical. You know that they burned her horse before her. Though it is not recorded, you know that they burned her Percheron first, before her eyes, because you know that story. So old, that story, the routine story carried to its extreme of the cruelty that can make of what a woman hears a silence, that can make of what a woman sees a lie. She had no son for them to burn, for them to take from her in the world, not of her making, and put to its pyre. So they layered a greater one in front of where she was staked to her own, as you have seen her pictured sometimes, her eyes raised to the sky. But they were not raised. This is yet one of their lies. They were not closed. Though her hands were bound behind her, and her feet were bound deep in what would become fire, she watched. Of greenwood stakes, head high and thicker than a man's waist, they laced the narrow corral that would not burn until flesh had burned, until bone was burning, and laid it thick with tinder, fatted wicks and sulfur, kindling and logs, and ran a ramp up to its height from where the gray horse waited, his dapples making of his flesh a living metal, layers of life through which the light shone out in places as it seems to through the flesh of certain fish, a light she knew as purest coming like that from within. Not flinching, not praying, she looked the last time on the body she knew better than the flesh of any man or child or woman, having long since left the lap of her mother, the chest with its perfect plates of muscle, the neck with its perfect prow-like curve, the hind quarters, pistons, powerful cleft, pennoned with the silk of his tail. Having ridden as they did together, those places, that hard, that long, their eyes found easiest that day the way to each other, their bodies wedded in a sacrament unmediated by man. With fire they drove him up the ramp and off into the pyre and tossed the flame in with him. This was the last chance they gave her to recant her world, in which their power came not from God. Unmoved, the men of God began watching him burn, and better, watching her watch him burn, hearing the long, mad, godlike trumpet of his terror, his crashing in the wood, the groan of stakes that held, the silver-black hide, the pricked ears catching first like driest bark, and the eyes. And she knew by this agony that she might choose to live still, if she would but make her sign on the parchment they would lay before her, which now would include this new truth, that it did not happen, this death in the circle, the rearing, plunging, raging, the splendid armor-colored head raised one last time above the flames before they took him, like any game untended on the spit, into their yellow-green, their blackening red. Thank you so much for coming tonight.
Linda, if you keep reading like that, we're going to drag you out of the woodwork more often.
I love to read.
Robert Booth is a writer and the manager of a national mental health care nonprofit. He has written a few books of nonfiction, including A Feminist History, The Woman of Marblehead, Mad for Glory, about nation building and imperialism, and Death of an Empire, about Salem's demise as a world trading center. Booth is finishing one more book of history, Untamed Spirits, about Marblehead and Gloucester in the 1600s, but has been overcome by the post-factualism and has turned to writing poems, fiction, scripts for documentary films, screenplays, confession based on a Salem book, and plays, The Long Trick, mainly about Gloucester. His hobbies are oil painting, baking, and candlepin bowling. He lives with his daughter and their cats and lizards in his native Marblehead and is trying to open a bowling alley in Salem. Robert Booth.
Hello, all. Thanks for coming out to hear my poems. It's really wonderful for me to be sitting in the back of the room and to hear Linda read. I had never heard Linda read, and it was a bit of a process over time as we became friends for this evening to happen, and it was really thrilling for me to hear Linda read these incredibly powerful poems that that the rest of us, I suppose, we've taken them in silence. But to hear Linda's voice was also a revelation, really. And Linda should have won that top prize. It's just incredible to me that you spent $500 just to get home with really nothing else happening as a National Book Award finalist. Anyway, I thought it advisable not to start off with poetry from my collection tonight. So I'm going to start with a short story. And several months ago, I started doing some automatic writing. I assigned myself some fiction writing every Sunday when I could make a hole in my life to do that, and without a whole lot of intention. So maybe unfortunately for all the rest of you, one afternoon, this guy showed up. The story is called Bigfoot. I saw the thing in the bushes when it was snowing in the conservation woods behind the old Legg farm. I was just starting out to check my muskrat traps, and I wasn't even cold yet, but I froze when I saw it. The thing was big, really big, bigger than a big man, very broad and hairy with dark hair, like a gorilla's, but shaggy and a different color, dark brown like a chocolate lab. What it was up to, I couldn't say. The snow was coming down, but the Yeti seemed to be doing something, standing with its back turned, pretty intent on whatever, something with its hands, like trimming a tree. In fact, it was just after Christmas, and I had just been inducted as assistant scoutmaster and had to recite that oath in front of everyone. At church, the Boy Scout tree was excellent, a Douglas fir that I picked out, very full, but not so thick you couldn't get the strands of lights in pretty easy, and even hang the bulbs back toward the trunk. Of course, this creature knew nothing about Christmas, but it did seem to have some fine motor skills, and that made me curious. Not as curious as scared, but still, it kept me watching. Since it was near Legg's place, my next thought was it might be Legg himself, although he was getting old and was always on the scrawny side. When it's cold out and you've got lots of layers on and a heavy coat and heavy boots and a hat, you can see him a lot bigger, especially from a distance. Legg, of course, was off his nut. He turned into a hermit, or nearly so. over the years, his farm, mainly cornfields and onions and pumpkins in the fall, had become a hardscrabble little forest, like a woodlot. But he didn't bother to manage it. It had grown so overgrown and dense in places, it was more like a jungle. In his spooky woods, he kept his quarter horses running wild, fenced in by barbed wire. He used to have a lot of cats there, too, back then. The story goes he'd talk to them, and I believe it. Some people, it turns out, especially girls and women, think of cats as pets, like dogs. Though usually, cats will not even come when called, and they don't seem to care about anything but themselves. You never knew where Leg would string the barbed wire. He changed it up and gave no sign or warnings, just you'd be walking along or wading through the bushes, and suddenly you'd hit barbed wire. I was one of the few who went back there to tend my trap line, and so I'd see his crummy cottage, about the size of a garage. He was a widower, and I'd see the shapes of horses drifting slowly around, big and little, and I'd hear the sounds as they grazed on bushes and weeds. If they got near the roadway, the boys would chuck a few rocks or fire their BB guns and make them stampede back through the trees. It wasn't exactly nice, but Leg was a mean and paranoid old dude, and really he invited these attacks, and not from boys only. Some people, amazing, did not understand the threat here. Even some with common sense, who should know better. They said, well, it's a peninsula, and no Yeti would ever come to a peninsula and not get spotted right away. And if it did, how could it escape? But this just proved the point. Something as intelligent as this creature could not only come to a peninsula and leave without being caught, but it might choose a peninsula deliberately to have the element of surprise. I'm not saying it was that smart, but you've got to be careful and realize that nature is not all squirrels and bluebirds, but coyotes are real. And so are intruders. And you'd better be prepared when you have clear signs that something alien and maybe evil is among us. Let's not pretend. So there I was, across the fields, not sure what to do. I breathed very slowly, stayed focused, and kept my wits about me. Of course, I cursed because I didn't bring my gun. It was too cold to get out the phone and take a picture, and besides, I was wearing my new hunting gloves, which were pretty stiff. I did try and fished around for it, but after I dropped it in the snow, I thought I'd better not. The creature didn't seem aware of me. It was so busy in the bushes. I said to myself, well, this is really something. Somehow, one of those abominables has got all the way across the country or come down through New Hampshire and set up in these very woods where I am. As you might imagine, it was exciting to think that such a famous, dangerous creature had come to our town. I kept at my posts, but enough's enough. I couldn't stay all day. I didn't dare to check my traps, even if I could outflank it and get down in the swamp. I mean, it still might have seen me, and then the race was on. I did circle around a bit, out toward the little bridge where the crazy woman used to go with the tricycles she stole and throw them in. She finally ran off with a blind man, but anyway, to each his own. The view from the bridge was no better, and I was more exposed, so I decided to retreat back to the road. Fear was not a part of it. I'd done my job, and by that time, my pulse rate seemed normal. It's just I didn't dare to shout for help, and I'd been out there for quite a while, a couple of hours at least, alone, and was certain that no one had seen me. When I got back to the church, I called Scoutmaster Duncan and told him, calm as I could. He had some trouble at first, but then he said he'd come right down. He showed up in his uniform, so he was taking this seriously. We talked a while. Did it make sense to go right over to legs and maybe walk into a trap? We agreed that we'd place a few calls and get up a posse from Fish and Game. Pretty much the same crew that had cleaned out the pond that fall, poisoning all the fish and critters so it could be restocked with smallmouth bass. Now, there's a plan that worked. It took a while, but they came down, some with their guns. Then Duncan had the idea that this would be good for the boys, and he started the phone tree, and pretty soon we had a lot of vans and all the dads and boys gathering in the vestibule and ready to roll. Before we headed out, someone contacted the police, and they spoke directly with me. I told them what I knew and the various particulars. They said it required some sort of action, and they'd meet us over at Legs. A lot of time had passed, so when we got there, it was getting dark. We had some flashlights, and the police brought over a portable generator and a fire department searchlight to give us a chance. The men went first. I was with them and the police. I showed them where I'd been. They made a stand there and sparked up the searchlight. Nothing. Not a trace. Just snow and the quiet bushes, which seemed so still and much farther off. Then I took them to the bridge, and we tried again, but no better result. It's hard to believe that anyone had to give testimony about this, the stupid selectmen, but everything ended up okay. We proceeded with the boys and got everyone in a line of march. They did better than I thought they would, and when we arrived at the spot in the dark, it was shocking. There were the cats, 20 or so, dangling there, hanging in the bushes and the lower branches of the trees, strung up in blonde manila twine and slip knots tight in their necks. I couldn't help but notice, looking close with the flashlight, that every cat seemed to be smiling, or more like grinning, so maybe it wasn't all that bad. The police were pretty pissed and told us to get out of there and take the scouts back to the church, which we did after a while. Some of the boys got upset, and a couple of them puked. There wasn't even blood or any cat left over or forgotten in the snow, and the Yeti's tracks were rubbed out by all our stomping around. It was never seen again. I spent some time with the detectives at the station, but Legg, of course, was the chief suspect. The police went to his cottage and brought me along to see what he'd say. I'd seen it a lot, of course, but had never been inside before. They took him up to the cat place and grilled him for a while, and finally they didn't arrest him because of me, I guess, and because he'd always kept cats, and some of these were his, and he made a big point of bawling and making awful threats. Things have not been the same since. The crazy bastard sold off most of his horses this spring and got himself the shotgun that he carries around. I decided to give up muskrats and spend more time with the scouts, so I don't go back to his woods. But still, I wonder what happens in that cottage of his, and if he doesn't have a couple of nice dresses that he puts on. That's the old marble head that I remember. Okay, so we're going to take a break from fiction, from automatic fiction writing, and this is a little poem kind of inspired by Keats's poem on first looking into Chapman's Homer, but it was actually my first look into Carman's Oxford Book of American Verse, which was put out in 1927 and is maybe the longest collection of lousy poetry ever put between boards. So this is called Dead Poets on First Looking into Carman's Oxford Book of American Verse. Of the best, so few of you survived the tyranny of rhyme, and sentiment cut down the rest. You brave Americans, misled by muses who would not undress, rode on undaunted to your doom on chargers and in phaetons, charmed by silkiness and pallid light and wimpling rain and fragile lilies, gathered in bouquets and never strewn. The waxing gibbous moon was big, and stars were too, and irony weighed in at half a ton. Against the glory of a thousand boys who fell to earth and shed their gore in Pennsylvania fields, a caroling with joy to thee, O death, you kept alive God's angels and the cherubs of romance, and never feared to succor allegory's nameful hordes. On went you in wonderlight and not in cars, tricked out in ballad forms and villanelles, like minstrels plucking lutes in New Orleans. Unacknowledged, illegit, you had no poem like a tree, or like the stumbling ghouls in trenches thick with gas. You were, alas, and hoping otherwise, the toothless bitch, and left the nation sexist, white, vindictive, crude, and in no mood for virginals, but ready to be groping when the house went dark, and from on high they started to unspool the silent movie. So this is a celebration of Christmas. It's called I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus. I do my best in this season of love and things. A mendicant at Walmart, stoned on Christmas bling, I nearly drop when from on high rings out the angel voice of the king of pop, so pure and so bizarre. The aisles of gaudy crap are glistening. This is a sadder poem. I seem to steal my titles quite a bit. So here's The Anatomy of Melancholy. Mouths crave kisses, neurons like to play. We're built that way, to float a while above our pain. The crazy thing called love will always ask for more, but hey, this carnal stuff, as near as we can get poor bodies with a brain. Of joy, I think, that in a day will fill with ours and sink. know where we are with time. 5 more minutes. So, there goes asking for it. Just as well. So we'll finish off with some short poetic fireworks here. This one's called Close to Home, inspired by almost any daily walk down the street in the suburb where I live. Close to home. Let's say a sidewalk and agree the devil's real and multiple. Your nameless neighbors, silent and unsmiling in the almost dark, stroll right on past you with their hybrid dogs. And when, a few steps on, you stop and turn to speak, you bark. This is a poem called Sleeplessness. I put out a chapbook called Sleeplessness. It had a poem called Sleeplessness and a short story called Sleeplessness. And then my lawyers made me not put the chapbook out. So there's a theme here, sleeplessness. Make me an incense seething by the pulseless sea, or let me be an ash upon a stone. I don't do well alone. If it's a dream, it's dreaming in a frame. Impasto in a half light, I figure in a dark design with no horizon and no sun, and headlands run to vanishing. And if it's not, let palaces and beacons pierce the haze beyond the sultry heights. Some epoch this will end. Some moment I will be transformed. The moon will rise and stir the ocean, roaring from its trance. It's not that simple. Silence meets desire, and transformation could be just what's happened here. Along the shore of entropy, a quantum state without an entry point. In squashed entanglement, far off the ticking arrow's course, I'm stuck in an equation's gears. See me, discord N, inferring correlation, awaiting fluctuation. Untouched by love or fear, as distant as two stars. How much I'd give now to confess. I'm lost. I'm drunk. I am unclean. My blood is bad, and I've turned mean, correct in my contempts, and shackled for my unenacted crimes. It isn't just the times. It's me. If I could pray, I'd give myself a God who had a voice and face and wanted company. From off the land, a breeze incites this frozen place. Across the cove, in spectral white, you pace the sand. Please, close my eyes. Come, take my hand. There's another stolen title. A guy named Yeats wrote a not so great poem called The Fascination of What's Difficult, but what a great title. So I stole it. And The Fascination of What's Difficult. Do not make me beg when really I would slowly set myself on fire to have one answer given from the heart. And don't forget who got you smashed the night you swore off drink and who made sure to pour a couple more. And this, my sauntering in irons, my needy hands in manacles unseen, and on my back, the burned-in brand. I've done my best for love of me to pull you in. The plan worked better than I'd thought when I began. Feels like maybe 5 minutes are almost up. Is there a hook?
There is. It's over there, but don't worry about it.
Okay. All right. I'm shedding poems like the autumn wind here. Who wants to hear that one? No one. I'm going to read a couple more. Too bad. That's a good one. Don't have time. All right, this one is called By Melville Sea. Here, where the pavement kisses the imported sand, the sea's an aftershock of some blue detonation. We come to get away. We get away to reconnect. The bubbly waves flounce forward, slowly falling short, and seagulls squabble by the bins. I'll do yours if you'll do mine. Let's just stay here in the sun and tan together. Lots of skin and no work to be done. Light breezes blow in. The surface shimmers silver like an infection's fever. You see the situation and you know we can't go in. So one of my little hobbies is Charles Baudelaire. I don't translate him. I write work that is after Baudelaire, I suppose. I think this is a wonderful poem that he wrote, and I did my best with it. It's called An Icarus Speaks. The well-fed Johns were happy in their whoring, while I wore out from chasing clouds. Amid the gorgeous stars of night, I went half blind while staring at their flames. I've soared with heedless joy and dreams of fame, and now, scorched by some fiery eye, my wings break up and I am falling, torched for love of beauty through the sky I thought would bear my name, but only proves my tomb. And I will conclude, as you might have thought I would, with postmodern romance. You never phone without a mouthful of something or other. You, entering a room, might knock down this and that and give a kick. With one invented word out of a spell, you fell the philosophes and settle in the rubble like a cyborg. At night, you won't arouse, insisting you're unwantable, deflecting every kiss, unless some drowsy catbird sings off key, unless the wind shifts west and babies' howls blow in, or herring school off certain capes, or all the waiting treetops fill with owls. You are that sphinx and lovely dancer whose answer to the adequate ideas is peeling down and climbing in the tub. You never wash your hair or scrub my back and won't sit still or grant it's even possible. Thank you.